Hey, what's up, seekers? Welcome back. Can religious rationalism and mysticism coexist? At first glance, you might think the two are diametrically opposed. Rationalism places logic above all else. It makes it the final arbiter of truth. In contrast, mysticism is more a domain of experience and the irrational. In the Jewish tradition, we find the contemporary mystical movement, which embraces a rationalistic philosopher and legalist as one of its guiding lights. But how could that work? Let's introduce our characters. In the popular conception, Maimonides represents rationalism and legalism in the Jewish tradition. In contrast, Hasidism typifies ecstatic mysticism instead of preoccupation with legal minutiae. Could these extremes in the Jewish tradition be harmonized? Chabad, a Hasidic movement founded in the late 1770s and still actively thriving today, embraced Maimonides. Maimonides became one of Chabad's most central figures, his works among its most valued and constant topics of study, and his philosophy a foundation of its mysticism. In this episode, we'll explore how the rationalist Maimonides could enjoy such a rich afterlife in a mystically oriented Hasidic movement. The Hasidic movement coalesces in the late 1700s as a powerful spiritual and social force in Jewish Eastern Europe. Many in the existing religious establishment felt threatened by the Hasidic spiritual revival and its tendency to de-emphasize the legalistic and intellectual elements of Judaism in favor of a more immanent, ecstatic relationship with the divine and a focus on prayer and devotion over scholarship, which had been a mainstay of European Judaism for centuries. The Chabad tradition offers a counterbalance in early Hasidut. On the one hand, the first Chabad master, Rabbi Shneur Zalman, known as the Alter Rebbe, frequently entered states of mystical union and ecstasy. Yet, he also possessed the command of Jewish law and Jewish philosophy, and in his legal Jewish philosophy, his legal Jewish writing rather, he stands out as a classical rabbinic legal scholar. Additionally, his voluminous writings, sermons, and lectures on Jewish mysticism have an intellectualistic and systematic flavor. Under the continued leadership of his disciples, his son and grandson, the Chabad literary corpus grew into the largest body of written Hasidic texts produced by any of the Hasidic movements. Perhaps surprisingly for a Hasidic master, for the Alter Rebbe, Maimonides' legal and philosophical writings play a crucial role. The Alter Rebbe's mystical, philosophical, and legal writings are all thickly laced with premises and ideas for Maimonides' legal and philosophical works. The Alter Rebbe fully embraces Maimonides, in contrast to his younger, highly influential Hasidic contemporary, Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, who accepts Maimonides' legal writings but vociferously rejects Maimonides' philosophy. Alter Rebbe's grandson, Tzemach Tzedek, the third Chabad master, distinguished himself as a leading Jewish legal authority in Eastern Europe, again uncommon for an early Hasidic master. He systematized his grandfather's writing and resolved apparent contradictions between his grandfather's writing and earlier Kabbalah. Furthermore, he synthesized important Jewish philosophical thinkers with his grandfather's thought. Maimonides plays a central role in Tzemach Tzedek's synthesis. Socially, Tzemach Tzedek worked to stem the tide of the Russian Jewish Enlightenment, and part of this social struggle involved writings and lectures reclaiming Maimonides' legacy for the traditionalists over the Enlighteners. Briefly, Jewish Enlightenment, a largely humanistic and secularizing movement that had begun in Germany, slowly began to infiltrate Russian Eastern Europe in the late 1840s. The Russian government saw Jewish Enlightenment with its tendency towards assimilation as a perfect answer to solving its problem of Jewish religious, cultural, and communal separatism from the rest of Russian citizenry. Jewish Enlighteners embraced Maimonides as a model for their religious project, which engaged in heavy synthesis between the Jewish religion and contemporary prevailing social values and cultures. They also looked to Maimonides as a model for demythologizing and rationalizing Judaism. Tzemach Tzedek attended numerous conferences in the Russian capital, where he and the Enlighteners battled over the fate of Russian Jewish education. Tzemach Tzedek worked hard in his writing associated with those conferences, as well as in his writings and lectures in general, to reclaim Maimonides' legacy as a staunch traditionalist. Rashab, Chabad's fifth master, led the movement through the growth pains of a hard encounter with modernity as the village lifestyle of 19th century Jewry fully collapsed at the dawn of the 20th century. replaced by urbanization, industrialization, social turmoil, revolution, and world war. In his mystical and philosophical writing, Rashab distinguishes himself from his predecessors by framing their work more straightforwardly, and his writing has a greater emphasis on motivating action on the stage of the real world. Rashab's orderly approach in teaching led him to be called the Maimonides of Hasidut, in that he, like Maimonides, engaged in a systematic project reshaping and presenting earlier authorities. Furthermore, Rashab's work is filled with concepts and premises from Maimonides' philosophy, as well as rigorous analyses and commentaries on those concepts. Finally, the seventh and final master of the Chabad dynasty, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, referred to as the Rebbe, fully established Chabad's headquarters in America and transformed Chabad into a dynamic, powerful, global social movement that is still rapidly growing and evolving in 2022, and by all accounts will continue to do so. From a scholarly perspective, the Rebbe excelled at synthesizing the legalistic domains of Torah with the mystical, and his more purely mystical writings tend to focus on the physical present world as the primary domain of encountering divinity. We'll explore the Rebbe's relationship to Maimonides more fully later in this talk. But briefly, the Rebbe instituted the daily study of Maimonides' works among his followers, a program of study that exists until today, rigorously followed by the Rebbe's adherents and even spreading to other contemporary Jewish groups. The Rebbe viewed this study as cultivating messianic consciousness in its students, a point we'll explore more. Finally, Maimonides' writings are a primary source of the Rebbe's integration of Jewish law and philosophy with mysticism. Now, having historically sketched Chabad's relationship to Maimonides, let's explore how Chabad understands Maimonides in more specific detail. When addressing Maimonides, it's important to note that in Jewish tradition and culture up until the present day, and certainly in the times of the Chabad movement, there's a bifurcation in viewing Maimonides. We might even say that there are two Maimonides. The first is Maimonides the legalist. While some rabbinic authorities opposed Maimonides' comprehensive, clear compendium of Jewish law, Mishneh Torah, when it was published, by the 1700s, Maimonides' legal writing gained full acceptance by traditional Judaism the world over as canonical. Maimonides received greater authority and sanctity, given the important role his legal rulings played in forming the opinions of Rabbi Yosef Karo's 16th century work, Shulchan Aruch, which by the 1700s had become the primary Jewish legal text, and Maimonides is unequivocally accepted amongst traditional scholars from then on. So Maimonides, a Jewish legal scholar, is undeniably sacred to normative Jewish tradition by the time the Hasidic movement emerges. However, there is also Maimonides the philosopher, and perhaps the mystic. And here, Maimonides' philosophical work, both the philosophy sprinkled through his legal works and rabbinic commentaries, but more particularly in his Moreh Nevuchim, Guide of the Perplexed, challenged many in the traditional Jewish world. Many chose to ignore the Guide of the Perplexed and caution against its study, though this did not majorly tarnish Maimonides' sacred status. Part of this wariness towards Maimonides' philosophy came from Maimonides' rationalism. While Maimonides occasionally writes mystically friendly lines, at first glance, Maimonides' general tendency towards rationalism and demythologization on display in the Guide of the Perplexed and the more religious and philosophical sections of his legal code might seem at odds with religious ecstasy and Chabad mysticism. So, we might expect that the Chabad school, with its deep commitment to mysticism and the Kabbalah's symbolic language, might also reject Maimonides. However, Chabad embraces Maimonides. How do the two teachings coexist? The Alter Rebbe offers an important teaching that contextualizes how it is that Chabad mysticism could be so different from Maimonides' philosophy, or how in general to account for the fact that Judaism articulates itself in so many diverse ways throughout the generations. In an 1806 lecture transcribed in his collection Torah Or, the Alter Rebbe writes, "We see in every generation and time that there are varieties of divine revelation in the world. In the Second Temple period, divinity revealed itself in the Mishnah and Talmud in a manner which divinity had not revealed itself in earlier generations. In the First Temple period, divinity revealed itself through prophecy and the like. Therefore, we experientially see that divinity reveals itself in different ways, and one generation is completely dissimilar to another, such that in one generation, divinity revealed itself in this manner, And in another generation, divinity reveals itself in that manner. So we see the author of Ben introducing us to the idea that earlier periods in Jewish history were characterized by very different forms of divine revelation. The revelation in the First Temple period, he tells us, is more prophetic and in manners similar to prophecy, while the mode of revelation in the Second Temple period primarily manifested through closely studying and explaining scripture and the traditions that were revealed in that time. The Alter Rebbe now goes on to discuss more recent Jewish history, outlining the different revelations throughout Jewish history up until this time. He says, "We see the differences in divine revelation even in the generations following the Talmud, and that is in the period of the Gaonim, which is the years 500 to 1000 in the Common Era. Divine revelation occurred in a manner different to that which manifested in the generation of the early halakhic decisors, or rabbis who lived in the years 1000 to 1200, such as Rif, Maimonides, and the Tosafists. And so things progress and change from generation to generation, to the extent that in recent generations, the manner of divine revelation changed from generation to generation. And these are all different modes of revelation, just that the hour requires that the revelation be in a particular manner, but the intent behind all the modes is the same." To summarize this quotation, the Alter Rebbe offers us an overview of Jewish history and acknowledges that each generation, and even different scholars within each generation or era, offered seemingly different teachings and paths of worship. These differences could be stylistic, or in the substance or focus of the teaching or mode of worship. Despite the apparent differences between Maimonides' teaching and Hasidic thought, the Alter Rebbe would see the two as different modes of divine revelation, appropriate to different times, but expressing the same core ideas. In the Alter Rebbe's retelling, each era and teacher he refers to are conduits of divine revelation. Chabad would maintain that the principal teachings of Judaism are cultivating an awareness of the unity that pervades reality, peace, commitment to others, to fulfilling the divine will, and to transcending the ego. There might be differences on an apparent level between the Alter Rebbe's teaching in Rambam and Maimonides, but the Alter Rebbe maintains here that the apparent differences are just an external garb, while the ultimate objective of all the teachings is similar. Thus far, we've understood how it is that Chabad and Maimonides can coexist, at least in the Chabad understanding, as a legitimate step on the path of Jewish tradition. But the Alter Rebbe didn't only see Maimonides as an earlier step along the path of Jewish tradition's continuing revelation. Instead, he grapples with Maimonides' writings throughout his own, showing how his teachings accord with those of Maimonides. One reason that the Alter Rebbe felt the need to show that his teachings agree with Maimonides is that the Alter Rebbe engaged in a rigorous project of Jewish philosophical mysticism and needed to make sense of earlier sources. He could not offer a philosophical Jewish mysticism without engaging Maimonides' opinions. Tanya, the Alter Rebbe's written masterwork, takes pains to show how each doctrine it teaches accords with the centrally accepted works of Jewish tradition before it. This includes Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, the Talmud, the Zohar, Lurianic Kabbalah, the entire canonical halakhic tradition, and Maimonides' halakhic and philosophical writings. Pinning doctrines on Maimonides, or at least showing how they cohered with Maimonides' thought, would be a good way of answering the reader skeptical of Alter Rebbe's ideas. If his religious ideas were consistent with an authority like Maimonides, then they entered the canon of respectable Jewish philosophy. But the Alter Rebbe likely also held that his reading of Maimonides disclosed a new layer of Maimonides' teachings, which may not have even been available to Maimonides himself. This accords with the Lurianic view of Maimonides alluded to in the second chapter of Tanya, that Maimonides' soul belonged to the Kabbalistic world of Biria, associated in the Kabbalistic tradition with the intellect. In contrast, Kabbalah tells us, the Kabbalists possess souls associated with the world of Atzilut, a world of the subconscious that exists in absolute unification with and directly channels the divine. Fasting forward to the final Chabad master, the Rebbe said of Rambam's writings, it would be impossible that Maimonides' limited lifetime, that in Maimonides' limited lifetime, just to clarify, Rambam and Maimonides are the same person. So the Rebbe said of Maimonides' writings, it would be impossible that in Maimonides' limited lifetime, he could have thought of all the many explanations that latter-day rabbis gave to his writings. However, Maimonides merited divine assistance to write in such a way that through him all matters would be explained. And the Rebbe says as well, these matters became included in Maimonides' writings by means of the divine spirit raising itself within him to allow his words to accurately align with the path, even without Maimonides' intentional awareness. So, while Maimonides may have taught rationalistic and even Aristotelian ideas, these ideas could be understood more deeply as grounding many mystical principles. But how could Aristotelian philosophical principles that Maimonides adopted enter the Torah canon? And how could Aristotelian ideas go on to ground doctrines in Jewish mysticism and symbolism? In answering these questions, Tzemach Tzedek, who you'll remember is the third Chabad master, directly addresses Maimonides' affinity for Aristotelianism. Tzemach Tzedek teaches, nothing is inherently wrong with Aristotelian ideas, and if they are adopted by an archetypal holy man like Maimonides, then they too can become holy. The idea status does not depend necessarily on the idea itself, but rather upon the perspective with which one approaches the idea. Expanding this point, Tzemach Tzedek writes in his work, Derech Mitzvotecha, this is a major principle, and it is the primary difference between the holy side and the other side, meaning the side of darkness, the side of evil. On the side of holiness, things exist in a state of self-nullification. In holiness, being, ego, is nullified. There is no I. However, on the other side, although those who exist in that state of consciousness know the divine, it does not affect any change within them. For they only refer to the divine as the supreme power, but they do not view the divinity as a force which demands unselfish perspective and behavior. This explains the spiritual archetype of the mixed multitude, of whom scripture says they stood at a distance, meaning to say they were mere spectators to divine revelation, not participants. This also explains the difference in philosophical engagement between the holy Maimonides in contrast to the wayward rebel Aristotle. For Maimonides, the more he understood divine truth, he humbly withdrew and became less in his own eyes. However, the more divinity Aristotle apprehended caused him to become more of a being, an ego, an I. His divine understanding led him to say, I am significant in my apprehension of God's existence and his oneness in my mind with demonstrative proofs. But Maimonides, the man of God, the more he understood, the more he cast himself aside as he perceived the divine before his eyes. To summarize that, strikingly, for Tzemach Tzedek, the problem with philosophy lies not in its inherent contents, but rather is a matter of context and perspective. Tzemach Tzedek does not assert any substantive difference between Maimonides and Aristotle's core teachings. Instead, he contrasts their perspectives. The historical Aristotle functions as the archetype of one who uses the intellect to enhance their sense of being and egotism, whereas Maimonides serves as the archetype of using the intellect to achieve greater sense of nullification and non-being, the objective of the Chabad mystical discipline. Chabad's embracing Maimonides was not at all a given for an early Hasidic movement. Let's contrast Tzemach Tzedek's approving take on Maimonides' Aristotelianism with a teaching from Rav Nachman of Breslov, an important Hasidic master contemporary of the early Chabad movement. In Chaim Ohran, teachings 407 to 409, Rabbi Natan, Rav Nachman's chief disciple, shares Rav Nachman's teachings on Maimonides' guide. Get ready for some very colorful and vibrant teachings. Rav Nachman tells us, one who wishes to save himself should keep the ultimate distance between himself and books of rational inquiry, such as Maimonides' Book of Logic and the Guide of the Perplexed. It is a great prohibition to study such books, for they ruin one's holy faith. Happy is one who does not know of these books and lives with naive simplicity. And our holy master of Nachman repeated this teaching many times without limit. And even that which Maimonides writes a bit of philosophy in his legal code, such as the laws of foundation of the Torah, a section which discusses metaphysics and physics, and the laws of ethics, which makes use of Aristotelian ethics in Greek medicine, and the beginning of the laws of idolatry, Maimonides' account of the genealogy of paganism and polytheism, one should run away from them and not look at them at all. And anywhere Maimonides engages in philosophical inquiry, one must run away. Our master, Rabbi Nachman, said that wherever Maimonides discusses halakha, Jewish law, he did well. But of the Guide of the Perplexed, God should forgive him for having perverted us with unrivaled perversions of the primary doctrines of our faith. And Rabbi Nachman said that one can see on a person's face if they studied the Guide of the Perplexed, meaning that one's face turned evil if they engage in such study. For such a person destroys the image of God that inheres in them with this study. And we see in our experience that the overwhelming majority of individuals who engage in this study became Epicurean pleasure seekers who rejected the Torah, and they should be suspected of transgressing all the sins in the Torah. One who studies this book will end in utter destruction. End quote. The Chabad tradition offers a more positive approach towards Maimonides' philosophical writing, particularly given that Chabad uses rational inquiry in its spiritual quest. Now, how might we account for these divergent Hasidic perspectives on Maimonides' philosophy? Rabbi Yisrael Heller, a living Chabad mystic, once taught that Chabad and Breslov ultimately both seek faith and transcending the conceptual mind. But while Breslov does so by avoiding the conceptual mind, Chabad strives to use the intellect to ultimately reach a place of transcendence that goes beyond the intellect. There's much more to this dispute, but at least that's the short version. So let's explore concretely. How does Chabad tradition use Maimonides and his philosophy to articulate religious ideas? Let's look at an example of an Aristotelian idea used by Maimonides, and then how Alter Rebbe uses that idea in Tanya to ground several philosophical and spiritual principles. A central principle throughout Maimonides' writings is his doctrine of divine cognition. The principle goes, he, God, is 1. The intellectually cognizing subject, 2. The intellectually cognized object, and 3. The power of intellection itself. Conclusion, all is one. That was subtle, so let's say that again. We'll call this Maimonides' doctrine of divine cognition. It is 3 elements, and it has a conclusion. Part 1, he, God, is 1, the intellectually cognizing subject. 2, God is also the intellectually cognized object. And 3, God is the power of intellection itself. Conclusion, all is one. Now, remember that last phrase. In Hebrew, it's hakol echad, and in English, it's all is one. We'll get back to this later. Breaking the principle down, let's say you're currently perceiving this episode. So you are the intellectually cognizing subject. You're a person who is engaging in the act of divine cognition, perceiving something with your mind. The video you're watching and its content is the object that your mind is grasping. And finally, your mind, your intellect, is the tool, the power you use to grasp the object. Now, you may ask, where does this doctrine come from? This doctrine which says there are 3 things, the subject, the object, and the power of intellection, and they're all working as one. Where does it come from? Did Maimonides invent it? Did he receive it in divine revelation? Actually, the principle originates in Aristotle's writing in a work, De Anima, where Aristotle discusses the human mind and applies this principle to human cognition, meaning he says that's the way that humans think. Humans have this property of divine cognition that when they're thinking about something, they, the idea of the object that they're thinking about, and their mind are all unified as one unit. So Aristotle talks about this in his account of human cognition. And he also discusses it in the Metaphysics, where he's discussing the mind of the Aristotelian God. Medieval Muslim philosophers integrated this doctrine of divine cognition into their philosophies, and Maimonides adopted the doctrine as mediated through their philosophical lens, which contained both Aristotelian and Neoplatonic elements. There's a lot to be said of this philosophical doctrine within Maimonides' work and its evolution from Aristotle to Maimonides, but let's fast forward and see how the Alter Rebbe understands it. For the Alter Rebbe, Maimonides' doctrine of divine cognition becomes an important part of the canon of Jewish texts considered to be divine revelation, and therefore, it serves as a proof text for certain doctrines which Maimonides likely never intended. Perhaps most relevantly for seekers of unity, the Alter Rebbe uses the doctrine of divine cognition to ground his monism, to claim that the only thing that really exists is the one, the divine, God, ultimate reality. There's only one thing. In the original meaning of the doctrine of divine cognition, it says that God thinking the ideas of things does not add multiplicity to God, since the idea of a thought object is always one with the thinker's mind. Since God is always thinking everything, all ideas are always one with God's mind. But according to this principle, only ideas are one with God, while physical objects are separate. Using some philosophical and Maimonidean premises, the Alter Rebbe rereads Maimonides' doctrine to say that when God thinks of anything, the divine mind also grasps all physical objects. So that means that the object exists in God's mind when God thinks of it. God is always thinking of everything, so nothing is ever physically separate from God. Ultimately, the Alter Rebbe uses the doctrine of divine cognition to prove the monistic conclusion that nothing exists independently of God, and that God is present in all things, since everything that God knows is unified with God. So Maimonides' tagline, the doctrine of divine cognition, that all is one, originally meant that thinking doesn't add multiplicity or parthood to God. But for the Alter Rebbe, all is one literally means the more ambitious monistic conclusion that all is one, nothing exists outside of God. The doctrine of divine cognition philosophically demonstrates how there is only one thing that exists because everything is one in God's mind. Now, if you want your fix of seeking unity today, maybe rewind a little bit and meditate on that argument. The doctrine of divine cognition does not only ground Chabad monism. The Alter Rebbe also employs it to ground his understanding of central Jewish concepts within Chabad thought. The first is mystical union by means of the Torah. The Alter Rebbe reasons that the Torah is God's wisdom. When a person thinks Torah thoughts, their mind unifies with the Torah thoughts, according to the doctrine of divine cognition. So it follows that by thinking Torah thoughts, which are God's thoughts, one becomes one with the divine mind. This turns Torah study from an intellectual exercise or religious obligation into a mode of mystical union. Alter Rebbe also uses the doctrine of divine cognition to show how tzaddikim, great spiritual masters, are conduits of divine consciousness in the world. We won't explore the technicalities here, but that goes to show just how broadly the Alter Rebbe used the doctrine of divine cognition. Let's reflect on what we've learned about Maimonides' doctrine of divine cognition and how the Alter Rebbe uses it. Maimonides and the Alter Rebbe operate with divergent metaphysics and hermeneutics. Given the Alter Rebbe's commitment to Lurianic language and metaphysics, as well as to the Zohar, this is expected. Yet, the Alter Rebbe used Maimonides' doctrine of divine cognition as a piece of divine revelation, which he could employ within his own metaphysical and hermeneutic system. The Alter Rebbe used the doctrine of divine cognition to underwrite his doctrine of the tzaddik in the Torah, positing a unification of these sacred objects with God. Perhaps more strikingly, the Alter Rebbe ultimately uses the doctrine of divine cognition, which, in its original form, states that the seemingly disparate parts of the divine cognitive act are one, to claim that all elements of reality are one with God, a monistic conclusion, given that all elements of reality are objects of God's knowledge. Maimonides would likely not accept the Alter Rebbe's conclusions, though an esoteric reading of Maimonides' doctrine of divine cognition might support a pantheism in the conceptual neighborhood of the Alter Rebbe's monism. The Alter Rebbe employed the doctrine of divine cognition, most often out of its original context, but with a deep understanding of its full complexity within Maimonides' work. He uses the doctrine of divine cognition to ground, articulate, and legitimate Chabad's most central mystical and spiritual doctrines. Now let's move on to another case study, another example of Maimonides and Chabad thought working together. So another interesting intersection between Maimonidean thought and Chabad thought is the discussion of the reasons behind Jewish ritual law known as the mitzvot, which literally mean commandments. Maimonides famously worked to rationalize and demystify Jewish ritual law in the third section of his guide. Chabad tradition devotes great energy to explaining how each Torah law is a symbolic spiritual map and may even confer transformed consciousness by mere engagement in the ritual. Let's look at a timely example, since this talk is being released around Passover. A central ritual commandment on Passover is eating matzah. Matzah is a flat, unrisen bread cooked hastily according to precise specifications. The Torah tells us that matzah recalls the hurry with which the Jews left Egypt, as well as the poor rations they received while in Egyptian slavery. Maimonides, in his guide, elaborates. Matzah calls us to remember the bad times when we enjoy good times, in order that we have gratitude towards God for the good times and cultivate humility and a modest spirit. Furthermore, Matzah serves as a memory aid for the events surrounding the Jews' exodus from Egypt. Chinuch, a work styled by Maimonides' guide, elaborates that matzah serves as a memory aid, a symbol for the exodus from Egypt and divine power. So we see that on Maimonides' reading, matzah cultivates good social attitudes that lead to one's life functioning in an orderly fashion, and in cultivating a good political unit, which is Maimonides' stated reason for most mitzvot, for most Jewish ritual commandments. In contrast, the early Chabad masters and Tzemach Tzedek read the commandment to eat matzah as accomplishing several objectives. First, matzah has a magical quality, which inculcates faith and experiential awareness of divine transcendence and monism by the very act of eating matzah. Relatedly, matzah symbolizes nullification of the self. Its flatness symbolizes the absence of the ego. In contrast, ordinary bread, which is puffed up and risen, symbolizes egotism. Furthermore, Tzemach Tzedek offers detailed meditations on matzah's physical symbolism as well as a letter meditation on matzah's letters to explain how the flat bread can inspire the contemplative to enter a state of self-nullification. What emerges is that at first glance, Maimonides and the Chabad masters appear to offer very different takes on the commandment to eat matzah. Could Maimonides' perspective and Chabad's perspective on the matter coexist? Tzemach Tzedek's Derech Mitzvotecha, a study on the ritual commandments, teaches that divinity reveals itself in layers. Each layer is distinct, but reveals a deeper dimension of that which came before it. Tzemach Tzedek relies on the Zohar's metaphor of the body, the soul, and the soul's many layers of consciousness as the model for understanding religious ideas and rituals. Maimonides provides the body. Kabbalah provides the soul. And Chabad thought, in Tzemach Tzedek's rendering, provides the core self, the one inner thing that grounds both the soul and the body, but transcends them both. Tzemach Tzedek tells us, although the Maimonidean perspective explains the Torah in a rationally straightforward manner, in truth, the Torah is concealed and revealed. And that which is revealed is in accordance with the concealed. And everything has infinite perspectives. The rational is like the body. The esoteric is like the consciousness. And in consciousness, there are many layers. So in contrast to certain rabbis' teachings on Maimonides' projects of reading the commandments rationally is heresy. The Chabad tradition accepts Maimonidean rationalism as a legitimate layer in a complex body. I'll leave the task of figuring out how Maimonides' perspective and the Chabad perspective on matzah match as a homework assignment. Reach out if you have any ideas on this one. So we've established that Maimonides has an important formative role to play in Chabad mysticism, and that the Chabad masters embraced Maimonides within their mystical and philosophical work. Now let's fast forward and see how the final Chabad master related to Maimonides in shaping the movement for the 20th and 21st century. The Rebbe made extensive use of Maimonides in forming Chabad religious consciousness. First, in 1984, the Rebbe instituted studying three chapters of Maimonides' legal code daily with the aim of yearly completion as a religious directive to his followers. This had significant messianic implications to the Rebbe. Quoting the verse in the book of Isaiah, chapter 11, verse 9, "The world would be full of knowledge of the Lord as water covers the sea," which is also the final line in Maimonides' legal code, the Rebbe taught that completing Maimonides' legal code each year, and thereby completing a compendium of the entire Torah, fills everyone who completed the study with knowledge of God, itself embodying the realization of a messianic objective. The Rebbe referred to Maimonides as the God of the perplexed, both in his own generation and in all generations, thereby embracing Maimonides as continually relevant, in contrast to many who wish to push Maimonides to the sidelines. Interestingly, the Rebbe praises studying Maimonides' philosophical writings. Particularly, the Rebbe spent lots of time teaching and expounding on Maimonides' philosophical portions of the Mishneh Torah. In contrast, you'll remember from earlier in the talk that Rav Nachman of Breslov cautioned against studying these sections of Maimonides' work. So, we have two famed Hasidic masters with divergent perspectives on how their followers should engage in Maimonides' philosophy. But perhaps most interestingly, the Rebbe sees the entirety of Maimonides' legal code, the Mishneh Torah, as a messianic work, telling a messianic story that a reader and community can enact. Taken as a whole, the work offers a path from contemplatively seeking divine unity, to realizing that quest on the lived stage of reality. Maimonides begins his work by setting the foundation, the mitzvah to know God. That's the first several chapters of Maimonides' legal code. The Rebbe takes Maimonides' metaphysics and physics as the scaffolding and jump point into Chabad mysticism. So on the Rebbe's reading, Maimonides provides a model for the Chabad mystic. The Chabad adept begins by philosophically contemplating unity and inducing mystical experience, but should not stop there. The quest must lead to concrete action. For the Rebbe, the concrete action is the halakha, or Jewish law, the Boko Mishnah Torah, which deals with things such as ritual and dietary laws, but also deals in great detail with laws concerning being a good neighbor, an ethical person, a good person to one's family, in a way that's dictated by concrete laws and not by mere ethereal sentiments. And in the Rebbe's reading of Maimonides' legal code, if one has the foundation of contemplative work and the path following a concrete legal regimen, those ultimately lead the individual and the world to the culmination of Maimonides' work, the realization of its last two chapters, which discuss the utopian but concretely real messianic future to come. Why did the Rebbe offer this intensely explicit messianic reading of Maimonides over the earlier Chabad masters? So while the Messianic era is a matter of great importance throughout Chabad's history, the Rebbe placed pronounced emphasis on manifesting the Messianic era on the stage of reality, instead of primarily focusing on Messianism through a contemplative lens. But Maimonides isn't just one more piece in the Rebbe's Messianic teaching. Maimonides plays a unique role in that teaching. The Rebbe distinguished himself by carefully integrating between the legal and mystical dimensions of Torah. He understood Maimonides' writings as the final halachic statement on the Messianic era and used them as scaffolding for many of his mystical Messianic teachings. So Maimonides' work serves the basis for integrating the legal and the contemplative, the rational and the mystical. Maimonides' vision of the Messianic kingdom adds another layer to the Rebbe's Messianic project. Rabbi Nachum Strux, a contemporary Chabad scholar, notes that Maimonides' view of the non-Jewish other as a complete participant in the utopian Messianic kingdom, motivated the Rebbe's campaigns of outreach beyond the Jewish world, which was a departure from earlier rabbinic practice. So to conclude this talk, who is Maimonides to the Chabad Hasidic and mystical tradition? For the Chabad tradition, on the one hand, Maimonides is independently a crucial link on the chain of divine revelation, and for Chabad, everything he says is of great revelatory, spiritual, ritual, and legal significance. The Chabad masters wove Maimonides into their mysticism, philosophy, legal works, and social projects. Ultimately, the Chabad masters, through what they perceived to be their unique divine revelation, understood themselves as disclosing new layers within Maimonides' teachings, which Maimonides himself may or may not have been consciously aware of. But through the course of history, Maimonides retrospectively served as the vehicle for their revelation. Finally, for the Rebbe, Maimonides provides a sweeping narrative which integrates the philosophical and mystical quest in the abstract on the one hand, but on the other, who offers a template for making sure that mystics and contemplatives hold themselves accountable in the quest, engage in concrete action, and not only contemplate in the ether. Instead, the Rebbe, through the vehicle Maimonides, calls his disciples to form their inner contemplative journey as the foundation for creating a redeemed inner world and helping redeem the world around them. We've only touched the tip of the iceberg here. There's a lot to be said in Maimonides' relationship with Chabad, but most of that work is only available to Hebrew reading audiences. But I'll mention two important works. One is a Hebrew work called Sachlatanut B'Levush Chasidi, which means Rationalism Hasidic Attire, by Rabbi Dr. Yaakov Gottlieb, which offers a somewhat different but fuller narrative of Maimonides' relationship to the Chabad tradition. Another notable work is Rabbi Y.M. Ezagwi's Dvar Malchut, which offers an exhaustive, nearly 800-page compilation of the Rebbe's essays and lectures on Maimonides' writings concerning the Messianic era. This is an excellent opportunity for those wishing to explore the integrative project that the Rebbe engaged in between Maimonidean rationalism and Chabad mysticism.